Good evening. When last we met, we were in Acts. Where are we? 23rd chapter, excuse me. I've been studying in the 28th chapter today, excuse me. So I pulled up the wrong PowerPoint. There we go. And see, I had the 28th ready to teach tonight, too. So let's see if we can find what we need for tonight. One more, and we'll be there. Well, we could have studied the 27th, 28th chapter, if that would have been fine with me. But I guess when last we met, we were in the 23rd chapter. And in verses 12 through 14, we saw that the Jews had formed a conspiracy to kill Paul. And then in verses 15 to 17, Paul's nephew heard that an ambush was going to occur and told Paul what he heard. So after hearing what his nephew said, Paul asked a centurion to take his nephew to the commander. And this is the only time we see anything about a family relationship for Paul. And then in verses 18 to 22, the commander takes that young man aside, hears what he says, and he believes him. So as we close class on Sunday morning, we said that the commander had basically three choices he could make. If he wants to please the Jews, all he has to do is let their plot play out. If he wants to impress everyone with the might and power of the Roman Empire, he could send Paul down to meet with the Jews under such a strong guard that these Jews could never touch Paul. If he wants to protect Paul and avoid overtly offending the Jews and bloodshed, he could send Paul away, thereby avoiding conflict. And I said as we close class, the choice that he makes, I think, speaks highly of his personal character and integrity. So as we begin class tonight, in verse 23, and he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form. And let's stop there for a moment. Lysias decides that he's going to send a formidable guard of 470 men, 200 soldiers, that's two centurions and their men, and 70 horsemen, plus 200 spearmen, to take Paul to Felix the governor. Felix was at Caesarea, the headquarters of the Roman forces of occupation and the home of the Roman governor. The commander did not want to merely send enough men to defeat the 40 fanatics if the soldiers were attacked. He wanted to send enough men to make sure none of them would dare attack. They mount Paul on a horse, not the way you would typically transport a prisoner, but certainly the way you might want to treat a Roman citizen. And we've talked about Paul being a Roman citizen. And they leave at the third hour of the night, which I think was about 9 o'clock at night. He sends a letter to Felix the governor, which we'll read in verses 26 to 30. Think of some of the interesting questions that can be asked about these events. Of all the people who might have heard of the plot against Paul, it was his nephew who heard and was concerned enough to tell Paul? Isn't that interesting? Was it an accident that the commander of the fortress of Antonia appears to be a man of integrity who will stop and listen to Paul's nephew and then make a conscientious decision to protect Paul at a great effort? Was it an accident or a chance that Paul was sent to Caesarea where he would be able to appeal to Caesar, chapter 25, verse 11, and thereby reach Rome at last? I would suggest to you that each of these shows a display of God's providence. In verse 26 through 30, Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. And I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. Verses 26 to 30 present Lysias' letter, and his note does not summarize exactly everything that happened. Notice in verse 27, he words the letter carefully to take credit for saving the life of a Roman citizen, rather than saying he broke up a Jewish mob intent on killing one of their own. He also does not mention he was going to scourge Paul. In verse 28, he says he wants to understand why the Jews were accusing Paul of wrongdoing. In verse 29, he says he determined the problems the Jews had related to the law of the Jews, not to the Roman law. From a Roman point of view, this means a Jewish dispute is not something about which the Romans really need to be concerned. Certainly, after investigating this case, Lysias has determined that Paul has done nothing wrong, nothing worthy of death or imprisonment. Finally, he says in verse 30 that despite the fact that Paul is innocent, he's transferring over to the jurisdiction over to the matter over to Felix, the governor, by sending Paul to Felix to prevent an assassination. If the Jews want to continue their accusations, they need to go to Caesarea too. Any comments through 30? In verse 31, so the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. Antipatris. You know, I need Freddie or somebody to do the pronunciation. The journey began with an overnight march from Jerusalem to Antipatris, thought to be about 12 miles east by northeast of Joppa and about 35 miles from Jerusalem. This site is thought to be about halfway between Jerusalem and Caesarea. The next day, they went on to Caesarea. As we look at this, in verse 32, but the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. The 400 soldiers and spearmen returned to Jerusalem. The 70 horsemen went on to Caesarea with Paul. It was only about 25 more miles to Caesarea, and they were on horseback, so they covered the distance fairly quickly. Any Christians who had heard the prophecy of Agabus, let's see if I'm going in the right direction. And the prophecy of Agabus was back there in the 21st chapter, about verses 10 through 12, where he said that he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and said that the man who owns this belt will be delivered into the hands of the Gentiles. Any Christians who had heard the prophecy of Agabus would perhaps be amazed at how quickly this prophecy had come true. The letter from Lysias to Felix delivered along with Paul showed that he had certainly been delivered into the hands of the Gentiles. There in verses 34 to 35, when he read it, he asked from what province he was. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, "I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also," giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Now, after reviewing that letter, Felix asks Paul where he's from, and he tells him. In response, Felix says, "I'll listen to you when your accusers get here." So Felix says, "Paul, you can wait in Herod's praetorium." It's likely this building was part of Herod's palace, which the Romans had taken for their headquarters. And this is going to be Paul's home for the next 2 years. Any questions through there? Let's go over to the next file. Good. As we look at where we are, let me make sure I've got my right notes in front of me, otherwise you're going to be surprised at how it goes. You know, since we've been studying since Acts, the 20th chapter, and about 16, we've been with Paul on a trip to Jerusalem and have studied his arrival in Jerusalem, his condemnation by the Jews, the false accusations the Jews have made against him, the intervention of the Romans, his transfer to Caesarea to appear before Felix the governor. It's still going to be a while before he ever reaches Rome. Some of the commentators believe that the events in Jerusalem happened around 58, 59, somewhere in that range, A.D. And, of course, we know that Paul's going to stay here in Caesarea for a goodly period of time, so it's going to be a while before he gets to Rome. In the 24th chapter, verse 1, it says, "After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders, with an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul." As we begin chapter 24, the Roman commander, Claudius Lysias, has in a sense passed the buck by sending Paul to appear before Felix. 5 days go by before the Jews show up in Caesarea. I would suppose the first day after Paul left Jerusalem, Claudius Lysias informed the Jews that he was no longer in the city. They then had to make preparations to go to Caesarea, and they traveled the 60 miles or so to Caesarea. And while Caesarea is north to northwest from Jerusalem, the verse says they came down to Caesarea because they dropped elevation about 2,400 feet to reach Caesarea. Verse 1 says, "Ananias, the high priest, brought some of the elders with him and an attorney named Tertullus." In the King James Version, the word attorney, Vine says, carries the idea of a person distinct from a professional lawyer was hired as a professional speaker to make a skillful presentation of the case before the court. His training was not legal but rhetorical. In other words, he was a good speaker. He knew how to place his words well. The reason I bring this up is to show that the Jews are going to great effort to present their case successfully. In verse 2, after Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation..." As an aside, don't we call that buttering somebody up? "We acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness." After Paul arrives, Tertullus begins making accusations. First, he compliments Felix for the peace that the Romans have brought about. Historians indicate he dealt with everything from robbers to organized bands of assassins to rebellions. History tells us that Felix was so corrupt and cruel, they finally even caused some rebellion among the Jews. But let's remember the relationship present at this time. The Jews hate who? Gentiles. Romans are Gentiles. So the Jews passionately hated the Romans, who occupied their lands and had conquered the nation and made Israel subject to the rule of Rome. However, since the Romans are in control, the Jewish leaders must, whether they want to do so or not, work with the Romans to achieve their purposes. Now, the chief priests of the Jews and some of the elders are standing before the Roman governor while this orator compliments the Roman governor. Don't you know that leaves a bitter taste in the Jews' mouth? In verse 4, "But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing. For we found this man a real pest, and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our own law." In verse 4, Tertullus says he is sure Felix is growing tired of being complimented. Then in verse 5, we see three charges being made against Paul. As we look, the first charge is a personal charge that Paul is a real pest. In other words, Paul is a first-class troublemaker, not the sort of right-thinking person that should be allowed to live. The second charge is more in the nature of a political charge. They say Paul is a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of a sect of the Nazarenes. Likely Felix would pay attention to this charge because the Roman government diligently kept the peace. At the same time, the charge has an element of truth in it, in the sense that unrest has occurred in many of the places that Paul visited. Paul has simply not been the person who started the riots and the unrest. The third charge is more of a religious charge in nature. As Tertullus says, Paul tried to violate the temple. Frankly, the Romans viewed this as a Jewish issue, which the Jews should have handled themselves as long as the people remained peaceful. The attorney then adds that as a result of these charges against Paul and the belief of the Jews that Paul is guilty, they arrested him and wanted to try him under Jewish law. Well, that would have been well and good, but look how he goes on. "But Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you by examining him yourself. Concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him." The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. In verse 7, the attorney continues by saying the Roman commander, Claudius Lysias, stopped them from judging Paul. Then in a twist of the truth, Tertullus basically charges the Romans with causing the violence as they took Paul out of the Jewish hands. Apparently they did not realize that Felix had in his hands a letter from Claudius Lysias, saying he had had to rescue Paul, a Roman citizen, from the Jews who were intent on killing him. Now, the Jews were trying to appear innocent, law-abiding citizens, when in truth, they intended to commit murder. Despite the law of Moses saying a person should not bear false witness, Exodus 20, verse 16, these Jews were quite willing for the truth to be misrepresented if it meant death for Paul. Let me stop. Any comments to there? Yes, Sherry. Uprising.
Any kind of uprising that comes about because Rome can't have that in Paul. And then you've got the Jews that
not a happy place to be if you're on either side of this equation. And if it's not a happy place, what's going to happen? You're going to see it pushed down and down, and time's going to go by, as we're going to see. In verse 10, when the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense, since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship." Felix allows Paul to speak. Paul responds to the charges of this slick-talking, polished lawyer by saying, "Just check the facts. Just check the facts." It might have been a difficult thing for Paul to do, except Jesus had told him he still had work to do in Rome, and this may have given him confidence. Christ promised his disciples in Luke 21, 12 through 15, "But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute." So, Paul says he'll gladly make his defense before Felix, who has been a judge for several years. One commentator, H. Leo Bowes, says Felix has been a leader in the area for about 6 years, but had only recently become governor of the area. Step one in Paul's defense is simply to state the facts. The first fact is that he only arrived in Jerusalem 12 days ago. Actually, Paul only spent a week in Jerusalem, and much of the time was time spent in jail. So if you look at what's going on, the facts of the matter are, on day one, he arrived and met with James and the church leaders. On day two, he made his first visit to the temple to worship. On days 3 through 7, he performed the Nazarite ceremonies and got arrested. On day 8, he appeared before the Sanhedrin. On days 9 to 11, he learned of a plot, or the plot was, was learned of, and there and a decision was made, and there was travel to Caesarea. Now on day 12, they're in the palace of Herod at Caesarea. So as a result of that, basically the point is, from Paul, when did I have time to cause problems, like they're saying? This certainly did not leave much time to cause the problems suggested by this slick-talking, polished lawyer. So, as we go to verse 12, neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Paul continues in verses 12 to 15 to present the facts about his life. First, in verse 12, he says they can't prove he carried on a discussion with anyone or caused a riot in the temple, the synagogues, or Jerusalem itself. The reason they cannot is because Paul used the temple for the purpose for which it is intended and did not profane it, as the Jews said. In verse 13, Paul goes to the heart of the matter and says plainly that his accusers cannot prove any of their accusations. Then in verses 14 and 15, Paul says he's a Christian. He then says, while the Jews call the way a sect, He does not. He says clearly he believes that he supports and does what he supports and does and believes in is in accordance with the law and the prophets. He says, I do serve the God of our fathers, having a hope in God that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Paul says he found the fulfillment of the law's purpose and the fulfillment of the prophet's message in the way, which is the gospel Christ preached. Paul clearly says he's not serving some new religion, but rather he believes in the God the Jews have professed for centuries and asserts that all he does and believes in is in accordance with what the God of the Jews has foretold. Paul and the early Christians did not see themselves as former Jews, but as fulfilled Jews, the true offspring of Abraham. Galatians 3, verse 20. For us today, belief in the resurrection is fundamental to what we believe as Christians. We're not like the Sadducees who were sad because they didn't believe in the resurrection. We not only believe in the resurrection of Christ, we believe it indicates the truth of all Christ taught and promised to us, including the hope of a home in heaven with him for eternity, if we live faithfully. Consider. Paul summarized what he preached in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, verses 1 through 4. Now I make known to you, brethren, the gospel which I preached to you, which also you received, in which also you stand, by which also you are saved if you hold fast the word which I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. That's the message Paul preached wherever he went. In verse 16, in view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd, without any uproar, but there were some Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you to make accusation if they should have anything against me. Paul now says to Felix that he stands before him an innocent man. In Paul's words, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience both before God and before men. As we look at this, it brings to mind the first verse of Acts 23 where Paul says to the council, brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. As we've discussed earlier, I think maybe Sunday, when we refer to conscience, we refer to that part of a man that encourages the man to know what is right and to avoid what is wrong. Since this feeling has been based on instruction, it's important that the instruction every person receives, us too, is to know what is right and what is wrong. And that's what we get from studying the Scripture. We learn what is right and we learn what is wrong. And then our conscience can help us make a decision on how to act. And that needs to be in accordance with what is right. So in verse 17, Paul says his purpose is in going to Jerusalem was actually not to profane the temple, but rather to bring assistance to his countrymen at a time when they had a need. Then in verse 18, he says, instead of being in the temple to cause unrest and problems, he had been in the temple quietly going about the offering of sacrifices related to the Nazarite vow outlined in Acts 21, verse 26. And then in verse 19, the thought continues that certain Jews from Asia were the ones that must have been in the temple when Paul was there, and they're the ones who should be present to face him and to make these false accusations against him. So where are they? Felix, where are they? These people brought Tertullus to do the accusations. Any questions or comments through verse 19? It's amazing how Paul is standing here against them. Sherry. Sherry. I think some of them followed, yes. That's my thought. Some of you may be better students. Anybody else? Andy?
It says Asia, so the most prominent congregation we know of is Ephesus. And so they're probably from Ephesus. You know, they could have been from another smaller congregation somewhere, but Ephesus is the main one in Asia.
But, and then as you come from Ephesus eastward, there were several congregations where they rioted and caused problems for Paul on his missionary journeys.
But probably Judaizing teachers coming behind Paul as they did throughout all of his ministries and trying to pervert the gospel that you had to be a Jew before you could be a Christian. And that even precipitated the council in Jerusalem where they had to take on this matter of, do you have to be a Jew? Can Gentiles be a Christian without being a Jew?
Great comment. Anybody else? Kenny?
The scripture that you have in Luke, I think, to me, that has a lot of meaning. The fact that Christ is going to be the one of God, you put the words, bring those things to mind, and say, take the thought about what you said. I'll give you. I'll be your defense. You know, attorneys today, I had some experience with that in business, they coach you. They have rehearsals when you go up before a committee or before a hearing, and they try to anticipate everything that's going to happen to you there. What questions you have? Don't say this, do this, be quiet there, don't mention this, all like that. With all that, no matter how much they give to you, that somebody, some sharp lawyer on the other side, or member of that council or hearing, will come up with something that nobody in this country spoke with. Paul, the apostles, they have the assurance that they will be told what to do. There can be no question that they can answer.
Very reassuring. Good thought. Now, I'm going to go on and read the next verses, but we're going to stop here at 20 and 21. But let's go on for just a moment. Paul went on and said, "Or else let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council, other than for this one statement which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you this day." When accusations were made before the Sanhedrin council, the Jews said in Acts 21:28, "This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." Where are these people that are making those type accusations? In Acts 24:5-6, the Jews accused Paul of being a real pest, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, and he even tried to desecrate the temple. So how did Paul defend himself? As Classians, let me just say, Paul told the truth. Well, the benefit of witnesses or his lawyer, but with the assurance of the Lord, as Kenny just mentioned, he witnesses that here's the truth, this is what he'll stand on, and he's going on to Rome and do the same thing. Paul is going to tell the truth. We'll stop here at verse 20, and I think that's where we'll begin Sunday morning. Thank you.